As they listened to him responding to this, Jesus told them another parable because he was near Jerusalem and they thought God's kingdom would appear right away. He said, "A certain man who was born into royalty went into a distant land to receive his kingdom and then return. He called together 10 servants and gave each of them money worth 4 months' wages. He said, 'Do business with this until I return.' His citizens hated him, so they sent a representative after him who said, 'We don't want this man to be our king.' After receiving his kingdom, he returned and called the servants to whom he had given money to find out how much they had earned. The first servant came forward and said, 'Your money has earned a return of 1,000%. The king replied, "Excellent. You are a good servant because you have been faithful. In a small matter, you will have authority over 10 cities. The second servant came and said, "Master, your money has made a return of 500%. And to this, the king said, "You will have authority over 5 cities. Another servant came and said, "Master, here's your money. I wrapped it up in a scarf for safekeeping." I think one of the translations says, "I put it under my pillow." I kind of like that. "I was afraid of you because you are a stern man. You withdraw what you haven't deposited and you harvest what you haven't planted." The king replied, "I will judge you by the words of your own mouth. You worthless servant. You knew, did you, that I'm a stern man, withdrawing what I didn't deposit and harvesting what I didn't plant? Why then didn't you put my money in the bank? And then when I arrived, at least I will have gotten back with interest." He said to his attendants, "Take his money and give it to the one who has 10 times as much." "But master," they said, "he already has 10 times as much." He replied, "I say to you that everyone who has will be given more. But from those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away. As for my enemies who don't want me to be their king, bring them here and slaughter them before me." And they lived happily ever after. After Jesus said this, he continued on ahead up to Jerusalem.
Morning. So when I was approached to preach a few months ago, I looked at the calendar and I thought July 5th would be great because Quakers are notoriously hard partiers on the 4th and there won't be many people here. And so Luke 19 was assigned for July 5th. Alas, it's a hard, hard parable. It provides another example of Jesus' stories that seem perplexing and hard to understand. In fact, in my Anabaptist Community Bible, the study notes to these verses say the story is confusing and contradictory, and that the parable has been seen as a parody or as eschatological allegory. Cool. That's something I really would like to focus on. So instead of talking about Luke 19, I'm just going to show you some vacation pictures. I did that a few summers ago here, and people seemed to love it. They came up to me afterwards with tears in their eyes, saying how lovely my vacations are, how blessed I am. to have such amazing travels. So here then are a few snaps from my summer so far. In June, Ron and I went to see our son Ryan in Denver. We did a few hikes, and then I got to do a bucket list thing, which was the Manitou Incline. It's a hike in Colorado that was a cable car track for miners, and now it's a torture device for thrill seekers. 2,800 steps going up 1 mile on the side of Pikes Peak. I loved the experience, thankful for every thin-aired breath that I was able to do that challenge. And then here's a few others from May, my juniors abroad trip to Spain, Portugal, and Morocco. Highlights included sea kayaking in Lagos, Portugal, riding camels in the Sahara Desert, and getting to experience the extraordinary history and food of these places with my co-leader and close friend, Jill Jameson, and 20 college students. Yeah, she's awesome. So I want to talk about my experience with friends when they ask me about my summer, and I want to run by some ways to talk about my vacation. So let me try this first. God has blessed me and my faithfulness by giving me the good gifts of health, well-being, and a job that allows me to travel internationally. God sees me mowing North Valley Church lawn once a month and being extra brave on the tippy parts, and I go to church nearly every Sunday. God has judged me as worthy of all good things and has richly rewarded me, looking down from wherever God looks down from and concluding, that daughter of mine, wow, she deserves everything for how much she loves me. And I'm going to give these summer experiences to her because she has done so, so much. Also, her humility is off the charts, which means I should heap even more blessings on her. I think a trip to Sun River with her entire family at the end of July would be just right. Okay, well, let me try this other one on you. I've been pretty lucky, having had the same amazing job at George Fox for 25 years. I work hard, sure, but also right place, right time. My body is strong and healthy, another source of luck, mostly, especially given how much sugar I eat every day. And also, I get to go on Juniors Abroad every year, in part because I'm on the committee that decides who gets to go on Juniors Abroad. I know how to put together a winning proposal for a trip, and I get to vote on the proposals that win. Plus, the co-leader I pick really knows how to do budgets, and our ability to stay within parameters each year means we are more likely to get the next trip. In other words, there are systemic reasons why I get to go on these junior abroad trips, more than specifically anything I do. Now, I think that version 2 is probably closer to the truth, although version 1 might be preferred by Christians who embrace what might be called a prosperity gospel. That is a belief that we deserve any goodness, including economic prosperity, because of our faithfulness. Because we go to church and pray the right prayers and read the Bible every day, and God has judged us as worthy of blessings. Well, those of us who are Quaker and Anabaptist might find a prosperity gospel somewhat foreign to our way of being in the world. I would argue that this kind of gospel is so endemic to our culture that our defining mythologies about our country rely on its ideology. And this ideology is so endemic to our culture, even those of us who ostensibly reject the principles of the prosperity gospel sometimes find ourselves captured by its false premises. But Luke 19, including this perplexing parable, might suggest that we are called by Jesus to another way. So in trying to puzzle through this particular chapter for today's sermon, I discovered that prosperity theologians often use this parable to support their ideology. The man born into royalty is gathering his servants and giving them a significant sum of money. And their rate of return reflects God's bounty given to those who make wise investments. The first and second servants know well how to invest, multiplying their money, and their faithfulness is rewarded with even more, more money and more power. In contrast, the other servant, acting in fear and not faith, hides away his money, makes no return on his investment, and receives nothing except for scorn. This reading suggests that the financial gain is a reflection of God's blessing. And the more one generously gives, the more shall be received. A fiscal bounty that reflects God's favorable judgment. Those who hold on tightly to their money, though lack faith, will not receive the reward of God's blessings, will not receive more money and more power. Financial failure itself is a reflection of sin and wickedness, deserving of a mean Jesus hell-bent, perhaps literally on condemnation. There's a simplicity to this interpretation of the parable, one that has been embraced by a number of Christians who long to see their prosperity as a reflection of God's favor, rather than of their own good luck or generational wealth or greed. It has also been embraced by pastors whose very wealth exists because of their parishioners' largesse, and who need folks from their congregations willingly coughing up their coins to be blessed. Consider the words of perhaps the best-known prosperity proponent, Joel Osteen, whose net worth is $100 million, and that's a picture of his humble abode. He said, God wants us to prosper financially, to have plenty of money, to fulfill the destiny he has laid out for us. Or Kenneth Copeland, who has a net worth of $700 million, lives in a tax-exempt parsonage valued at $10 million, and says that financial harvests are not seasonal. If you give, you will receive. You may not receive the harvest immediately, but if you plant, you will always be on the receiving end. The word says to cast your bread on the water, and after many days it will return to you. Give, 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 expecting to receive, so you can give, give, give. Somebody's got to pay for the 3 private jets that Copeland owns, after all. And one more example, Paula White Cain, President Donald Trump's spiritual advisor, has specifically asked her followers for seed money. $1,000 at Passover to receive supernatural blessings. On another occasion, money to receive prophetic instruction for vanquishing enemies. Sowing these seeds financially, she says, will trigger God to reward the givers financially as well as spiritually. It's easy to disregard these prosperity preachers as radicals who don't represent Christianity. Yet this kind of biblical interpretation, where God judges our actions and blesses with wealth those who give generous financial gifts, has caused unimaginable suffering to folks who have made significant financial sacrifices without concurrent rewards. People who might have given all they have to the church then wondered what was wrong with them personally, or perhaps could not give anything because they are barely surviving financially, and hear from the pulpit that they are judged wicked, living in fear rather than faith, unworthy of the bounty God has given them. As Ed suggested, other passages in Luke 19 seem to undermine this prosperity reading. Though it's curious that so few prosperity pastors want to include these verses in their scriptural interpretation. Consider the story that opens Luke 19, where Zacchaeus, a rich man and a ruler among tax collectors, wanted to see Jesus and climbed into a tree for a view. Jesus sees him and asks to be invited to Zacchaeus' house for dinner, causing scorn in the crowd, who cannot believe Jesus would be with this sinner, given a tax collector's reputation as someone willing to skim money off of taxes paid for his own benefit. When Zacchaeus tells Jesus that he gives half his possessions to the poor and says that if I have cheated anyone, I repay him 4 times as much, Jesus responds that today's salvation has come to this household. In my Anabaptist Community Bible, this verse is footnoted with a quote from Menno Simons, who said Zacchaeus was rich, and 1/2 of his wealth he gave to the poor. But our rich people seek more and more how they may increase their money and possessions, build their houses expensively, and add field to field. They do not care about the needs of the poor and the needy. They are unmerciful, proud, avaricious, and given to luxury. This feels like an anti-prosperity gospel message, if there ever was one, and also really speaks to our own time, as it did 500 years ago when Menno Simons wrote this, truly suggesting that there is nothing new under the sun. Or consider the story that ends Luke 19, where Jesus clears the temple. This account is the shortest of the Gospels, only one paragraph. When Jesus entered the temple, he threw out those who were selling things there. He said to them, "It is written, my house will be a house of prayer, but you have made it a hideout for crooks." Despite its brevity, the image is compelling, a reminder that when churches become sites for commerce, they're focused on financial gain rather than worship. They become a haven for crooks, an affront to Jesus. Again, an anti-prosperity gospel message. We may be so far from this kind of wealth-based theology that we don't recognize it and don't recognize this kind of reading of Luke 19. But as I suggested earlier, this kind of ideology is endemic to our culture. I need to say here, especially on the heels of July 4th, that I love my country. When it's at its best, when it meets its aspirations, and I recognize the many privileges I have given that I was born here. And still, I also recognize when people say that God, or that America is the wealthiest, most powerful nation in the world because of God's unique blessing, they fall prey to a prosperity message that ties our country's wealth to God's favor. Rather than recognizing that other forces may have contributed to our ascendancy as a powerful nation. The 400 years enslavement of humans, for example, that allowed our country to be built on essentially free labor and also a horrendous oppression. Or our ancestors' tendency to take and reap on land that wasn't theirs to sow. Or now our perpetual willingness to funnel money into the world's most powerful military rather than social services that would help people thrive. America's priorities don't seem like markers of a God-blessed country, yet we want to ardently believe that it's our country's willingness to act in faith that makes us so much wealthier, reflecting God's special judgment. We also might have the ideas of prosperity gospel so embedded in our hearts and minds, we don't recognize how we often fall prey to its ideologies. When I say, for example, that God has blessed me with a terrific job, a beautiful international trip, and continuous good health as a reward for my faithfulness, if I say God has found favor with me and given me these tangible things, what might that suggest to people who have likewise been dedicated to their faith? Or even more so than I am, but who hate their jobs, or who struggle with illness, or who haven't had the opportunity to travel overseas? Do we mean to suggest that God doesn't give blessings to folks who are struggling? That God is transactional, deciding who gets more material blessings by virtue of their dedication to God? Of course, I want to resist this idea. And yet, how often do I choose to act because I think God will respond with goodness? Or how often do I not act, then worry that the hammer is going to drop, that God will respond to my passivity with punishment? Fundamentally, that kind of thinking suggests a belief in God as a divine being who gives out judgment first and foremost, judging who is deserving and who is not simply based on how we act. And while I want to say I don't believe in God, a God who has this level of petty judgment, the way I act and what I sometimes say betrays me. This view of a transactional God also gets us off the hook in a way, allowing us to see the good things in our lives as a result of our own actions rather than compelling us to consider the systemic reasons we might be enjoying the good life because of where we were born. Or the color of our skin, or our access to medical care. If we credit God's favor with the easier life we've been given, we don't have to face the truth sometimes that our lives are made easier on the backs of other humans and other broken systems, and we don't have to do the work to create justice for all. So let's return to the parable in Luke 19. What if we understood this parable as metaphoric for the extravagant gift of God's love in our lives? We are all given that particular gift in abundance and decide what we will do with it. It could be that we hoard that love, hide it away, deciding that we don't need to share love unconditionally with others, a kind of self-centeredness that sees God's unconditional love poured out on us without recognizing that we in turn need to pour out that same level of love or more on others. In this interpretation, someone could have done everything right, gone to church, read the Bible, served the church well, never strayed from the path of righteousness of his own accord. But if he hasn't extended love to his neighbors, he is wicked, unwilling to share the essential gifts that God has given him. But the one who shared these good gifts with others, who extravagantly shared love and grace and mercy, that person will receive what is truly God's blessing. 5 and 10-fold over, not in terms of money, but in terms of the richest kind of reward, God's love expressed through how they treat and respond to others in right relationship. This interpretation has some problems, I'll admit, especially in terms of understanding a noble person who doles out love in abundance, then turns all mean when those gifts are hoarded rather than shared. To be honest, the noble person's brusqueness bothers me. Even here, biblical scholars don't agree on who the noble person is, saying that the parable represents an unjust kingdom with an impetuous ruler rooted in the historical tyranny of Caesar Augustus, the noble man being Caesar's son. Others see the parable as a reflection of Jesus and his divine judgment. In this interpretation, when Jesus returns for the second coming, the wicked will be cast into hell for all eternity. As somebody who ascribes neither to an end times theology nor a fire and brimstone understanding of God, willing to internally wreck those who don't proclaim Jesus, I'm unsettled by these readings too. Why would the Prince of Peace request that the wicked be killed right in front of him? So, is this parable about a transactional God intent on divine retribution, or about the depths of God's love, God's grace, and God's mercy? To be honest, I don't know. When folks are certain that the Bible is clear, that we don't need any interpretation, I'll point to this parable as evidence that sometimes the Bible is not clear. I'd like to think, though, that the parable is not only about God's love, but about the limits of that love if we, in turn, don't pass that love along to others. As I was puzzling through this parable, I was reminded of my favorite memoir, Everything Sad is Untrue, A True Story, which I've shared about already ad nauseum here in church, so go and read it, it's really good. What Daniel Nayeri writes about his experience as a brown, poor kid attending middle school in Oklahoma, where his family has landed after his mom's conversion to Christianity and their escape from Iran. His family life is the antithesis of the prosperity gospel, despite his mom's significant sacrifices to follow Jesus. Loss of her homeland, of her family, her status, nearly loss of her life. Nayeri wonders about the nature of God, saying, "A God who listens is love. A God who speaks is law." At their worst, the people who want a God who only listens are self-centered. They just want to live in the land of do as you please. And the ones who want a God who speaks are cruel. They just want laws and justice to crush everything. Love is empty without justice. Justice is cruel without love. God should be both. So I wonder, is the person of royalty in this parable a God who reflects love and justice? Extends us grace and mercy and love, and then implores us to extend the same grace and mercy and love to others? How does this parable allow us to see what God really asks of us, what God requires of us, and what are we willing to give others? Not as the world giveth, as prosperity preachers want us to believe, but something else. Perhaps a God who asks us to walk with humility, to love mercy, and to be just. In other words, loving others as a pathway to loving God, the greatest gift we can give and receive. That pathway is certainly the most challenging, but ultimately probably the most divine. All right, so there are several queries. And we'll have a little bit of quiet worship to consider these. Where has prosperity theology complicated your ability to love others well? Are we self-centered when God extends love to us? And what does God really require of us?